against an apostate nation. A continuation of the consideration of the prophecy of Isaiah. Jehovah God has a purpose. That is a fundamental truth expressed in Scripture. God is not aimless, haphazard, or uninterested in the goings-on of His wayward creation down here, as some may suppose. On the other hand, neither does He choose to control every detail and facet of life, as some religionists believe. To be sure, though, God's purpose is to set up a kingdom over mankind and destroy the present ruling elements over the world, which are certain to be weighed in the balances and found wanting. Back in the beginning of the world, on the very day the original humans defected to follow the advice of a God-slandering snake, Jehovah issued the original prophecy, speaking to the original serpent, saying to it, "Because you have done this thing, you are the cursed one out of all the domestic animals and out of all the wild beasts of the field. Upon your belly you will go, and dust is what you will eat all the days of your life. And I shall put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He will bruise you in the head, and you will bruise him in the heel." Because in their naivety, Adam and Eve apparently imagined that the serpent could actually speak. Jehovah addressed himself to the serpent as if it were the actual source of the misleading statements. Not until many centuries later, with the revelation of the foretold primary seed of the woman, Christ Jesus, would the truth be revealed, namely, that the serpent was merely a front for an angel gone bad, who became the original liar and slanderer of Jehovah. But in the concise, albeit cryptic, prevision, Jehovah set into motion his dynamic purpose to produce a serpent-stomping victorious seed. Several centuries after the great deluge drowned the Nephilic seed of the serpent and forced the rebel angels to retreat into the invisible realm, Jehovah established a covenant with Abraham and revealed that all nations would be blessed through the seed of Abraham, through the line of Isaac and Jacob, also known as Israel. As the descendants of Abraham became populous, after about 500 years, God formed the 12 tribes of Israel into a nation and established His covenant with them, giving them His law and setting up an organization of priests. In time, the Israelites requested a human king to rule over them, and so God selected David, the son of Jesse, and established a covenant with him, signifying that the Christ would be a descendant of David and sit upon Jehovah's throne on Mount Zion. Through the prophets of Israel, many more details of the coming Messiah were revealed. Concerning him, Isaiah confirmed that the Messiah would indeed come through the line of Jesse and that he would judge the nations, save the meek and lowly, and kill off the earthly offspring of the serpent. "And there must go forth a twig out of the stump of Jesse, and out of his roots a sprout will be fruitful. And upon him the Spirit of Jehovah must settle down, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and of mightiness, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Jehovah. And there will be enjoyment by him in the fear of Jehovah." But the same prophecies in Isaiah that foretell the coming of the twig from the stump of Jesse also decreed that the kingdom of God was going to be cut down, and the seat of the kingdom, Jerusalem, would be plowed up as a mere field. That is because the enemy seed corrupted Jehovah's nation. So how could God fulfill His covenant to produce a kingly Messiah through Judah and the line of David? Well, God corrected and restored his people to their homeland, and the lineage of David stayed intact. But the prophecy considered here pertains to Messiah's second coming. Going on, the prophecy states, "And he will not judge by any mere appearance to his eyes, nor reprove simply according to the thing heard by his ears. And with righteousness he must judge the lowly ones, and with uprightness he must give reproof in behalf of the meek ones of the earth. And he must strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the spirit of his lips he will put the wicked one to death. And righteousness must prove to be the belt of his hips, and faithfulness the belt of his loins." The cobra is one of the most venomous and aggressive reptiles known to man. We do not know, but it may well have been a cobra that Satan used to speak to Eve in Eden. In any case, Isaiah goes on to foretell that under the reign of the Messiah, the blessed ones of Jehovah will enjoy complete peace and security, such as once existed in Eden. And the wolf will actually reside for a while with the male lamb, and with the kid, the leopard itself will lie down, and the calf, and the maned young lion, and the well-fed animal altogether, and a mere little boy will be leader over them. And the cow and the bear themselves will feed. Together their young ones will lie down. And even the lion will eat straw, just like the bull. And the suckling child will certainly play upon the hole of the cobra. And upon the light aperture of a poisonous snake will a weaned child actually put his own hand. They will not do any harm or cause any ruin in all my holy mountain, because the earth will certainly be filled with the knowledge of Jehovah as the waters are covering the very sea. God's original purpose for man and woman was for them to have in loving subjection all the birds of the heavens, the fish of the sea, and every animal upon earth. But because Adam and Eve subjected themselves to Satan instead, ever since then the world of humankind has taken on an animalistic character. Instead of having in subjection the animal kingdom, men have dominated their fellow man. The cunning dominate the innocent, the aggressive dominate the passive, the wealthy dominate the poor, the strong dominate the weak. Empires dominate nations, and on it goes. So, according to Isaiah's prophecy, Messiah's rule will establish Edenic tranquility among those who accept his reproof. As Jehovah's Witnesses realize, the prophecy really speaks of a changed condition among people, not animals. The aggressive, cunning, and hurtful tendencies of sinful men and women will be tamed. No one will harm another person, not physically, mentally, or emotionally. It will be an entirely new earthly system of things, nothing short of a new world. How wonderful that will be! As strange as it may seem to the uninformed, though, Jehovah's Witnesses have been led to believe that this new world of peace and absolute security has already come into existence in the form of the New World Society of Jehovah's Witnesses. Incidentally, the condition foretold in Isaiah has been termed by the Watchtower Society as spiritual paradise, although that exact phrase does not appear in the scriptures. But the so-called spiritual paradise envisioned in prophecy is not brought about by mere doctrinal uniformity, such as exists among Jehovah's Witnesses worldwide. Spiritual paradise will be characterized by a complete absence of evil, such as existed for a fleeting moment in Eden. Needless to say, no such blissful condition exists presently among Jehovah's Witnesses. Neither did it exist among the original Christians. But what is the significance of the fact that the twig of the stump of Jesse, Christ, who will bring about this blessed condition, will do so in the aftermath of the destruction of Israel? Surely no such paradisaical society came into existence when the impoverished Jewish exiles returned to Palestine from Babylon, which was before even the twig of the stump of Jesse sprouted. Hold that thought. Reverting to the 10th chapter of Isaiah, there God declares his determination to set matters straight with his apostate nation. After issuing a chilling woe to those enacting harmful regulations, God announces the means through which his denunciation shall be executed, saying, "Aha! The Assyrian, the rod for my anger, and the stick that is in their hand for my denunciation. Against an apostate nation I shall send him, and against the people of my fury I shall issue a command to him to take much spoil, and to take much plunder, and to make it a trampling place, like the clay of the streets." The apostate nation and the people of God's fury were originally the Israelites. In 740 BCE, the Assyrians plundered the Israelite capital, Samaria, and led off into exile the northern 10-tribe kingdom of Israel. Emboldened by his conquest of Samaria, about 8 years later, the Assyrian king Sennacherib demanded that the Judean king Hezekiah also surrender to him. Isaiah attributed these words to the king of Assyria before ever he initiated his campaign against Israel. "Is not Samaria just like Damascus? Whenever my hand has reached the kingdoms of the valueless God, whose graven images are more than those at Jerusalem and at Samaria, will it not be that just as I shall have done to Samaria and to her valueless gods, even so I shall do to Jerusalem and to her idols?" The Assyrian made a fatal mistake in assuming that Jehovah was a mere valueless idol god. It was on that occasion that Jehovah dispatched an angel who slew 185,000 Assyrian troops in one night, thus thwarting the conquest of Jerusalem. But the fact of the matter is, Jerusalem too had succumbed to idolatry. There were only a few faithful Judean kings, Hezekiah being one of them, who made significant reforms and who were faithful to the God of the covenant. But in that context, Jehovah stated, "And it must occur that when Jehovah terminates all his work in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, I shall make an accounting for the fruitage of the insolence of the king of Assyria and for the self-importance of his loftiness of eyes." As all Bible students surely know, God eventually had Jerusalem destroyed as well by the Babylonians. But why then does God state that all his work in connection with Mount Zion and Jerusalem is terminated when the insolent Assyrian is called to account? Not only that, but the prophecy in the 10th chapter of Isaiah speaks about only the remnant of Jerusalem being saved. These questions are all the more relevant when the 28th chapter of Isaiah is considered. For example, in verse 21, God refers to his strange deed and his work in connection with the destruction of Jerusalem by the nations. Clearly, then, God's work in connection with Jerusalem did not end with the Assyrian defeat. Why, then, does Isaiah 10:12 speak of the termination of all of God's work in connection with Mount Zion and Jerusalem? Worded differently, why did God prevent the Assyrian from taking Jerusalem, only to later sanction the Chaldeans to do so? The answer is, the conquest of Israel and the salvation of Jerusalem and the remnant of Israel, depicted in the 10th chapter of Isaiah, is really a pattern for the Christian Israel of God at the coming of Christ. That ought to be apparent due to the fact that, as mentioned above, the Messiah comes for judgment in the context of Israel's downfall. Interesting, too, Isaiah 9:6 introduces the coming Messiah as the mighty God and Prince of Peace, whereas Isaiah 10:21 states, a mere remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. The mighty God, in the context of this passage of prophecy, is a prophetic reference to the Christ at his second coming. The mere remnant of Jacob that returned to him are the so-called anointed remnant, those spiritual Jews remaining on earth after the first resurrection begins, who, together, are the true seed of Abraham. But a return to Christ, the mighty God, by Christians must, of necessity, mean that they have left off following him. And for an anointed Christian to cease from following Christ would be tantamount to apostasy. Keep in mind that the reason for God's denunciation in the first place is because his nation has become apostate. But God's purpose in connection with his apostate nation will ultimately be successful due to the fact that a remnant will be saved. In other words, God's purpose to establish a world-ruling kingdom composed of formerly sinful humans, transformed by Christ's mediation and reproof in their behalf, is accomplished by means of the destruction of his earthly organization and the regathering of a chastened remnant into heavenly Zion. No true understanding of prophecy is possible without recognizing that vital fact. Paul alluded to this truth of God's purpose when he prophetically stated, "Why do you not know that the Scripture says in connection with Elijah, as he pleads with God against Israel, 'Jehovah, they've killed your prophets, they've dug up your altars, and I alone am left, and they are looking for my soul.' Yet what does the divine pronouncement say to him? 'I have left 7,000 men over for myself, men who have not bent the knee to Baal. In this way, therefore, at the present season also, a remnant has turned up, according to a choosing due to undeserved kindness.'" Although Paul was ostensibly speaking with reference to the relatively small number of Israel who accepted Christ in the first century, the 11th chapter of Revelation similarly alludes to a return of Elijah and the 7,000 as an immediate prelude to Armageddon. Not only that, but the prophecy of Malachi addresses itself to the preparatory work of Elijah prior to the end of the system. "Look, I am sending to you people Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and fear-inspiring day of Jehovah, and he must turn the heart of fathers back toward sons, and the heart of sons back toward fathers, in order that I may not come and actually strike the earth with a devoting of it to destruction." If Elijah returns to turn the hearts of fathers and sons back to each other, is that not an indication that their hearts have been led astray from Jehovah himself? Surely, such is the case. While it is readily recognized by Jehovah's Witnesses that the churches of Christendom are apostate and have been for centuries due to their many worldly entanglements, among other things, the mere suggestion that the Watchtower Society could possibly be judged by Jehovah as being apostate is unthinkable. And yet, the prophecy of Isaiah, and all other prophecy for that matter, which constitute the very judgments and judicial decisions of Jehovah for the final part of the days, clearly indicate that God's purpose is accomplished through the destruction of Israel by the Assyrian. God always holds the leaders more accountable than the led, or the misled, as the case may be. In the instance of ancient Israel, not only were the judges guilty of enacting harmful regulations that defrauded the lowly, God indicted the leaders for faithlessly making alliances with Israel's enemies. The purpose of God's disciplinary action, as stated at Isaiah 10:20, is so that it will certainly occur in that day that those remaining over of Israel and those who have escaped of the house of Jacob will never again support themselves upon the one striking them, and they will certainly support themselves upon Jehovah, the Holy One of Israel, in trueness. In their commentary on this chapter of Isaiah, the Watchtower Society asked, "Will Jehovah's faithful witnesses perish along with Babylon the Great? No, God is not displeased with them. Pure worship will survive." Thus, Bethel's Bible interpreters recognize the surviving remnant of Israel to be Jehovah's Witnesses. But according to the Watchtower visionaries, Israel represents Babylon the Great. If that were true, though, then how is it that the surviving remnant are part of Israel up until the time the modern Assyrian annihilates it? Jehovah's Witnesses believe they will have gotten out of Babylon long before it is destroyed. This inconsistency of interpretation and lack of understanding on the part of the leaders of God's people prior to the coming of Christ is ironically a significant feature of the prophecy of Isaiah itself. For example, Isaiah 29:10-12 states, "For upon you men Jehovah has poured a spirit of deep sleep, and he closes your eyes, the prophets, and he has covered even your heads, the visionaries. And for you men, the vision of everything becomes like the words of the book that has been sealed up, which they give to someone knowing the writing, saying, 'Read this out loud, please.' And he has to say, 'I am unable, for it is sealed up.' And the book must be given to someone that does not know writing, somebody saying, 'Read this aloud, please.' And he has to say, 'I do not know writing at all.'" In terms of their understanding the judgments of Jehovah yet to be unveiled, the prophecy of Isaiah is a closed book to the leadership of Jehovah's Witnesses, sealed up, as it were. In modern times, the Watchtower Society has supported itself upon the modern Assyrian. This has been manifested in the disgusting compromise the Watchtower Society made with the United Nations in consigning Jehovah's Witnesses to serve as mere couriers for UN globalist propaganda between the years of 1992 and 2001. Even in the aftermath of that fiasco, Bethel has spawned numerous subsidiary NGOs for the purpose of influencing European policymakers and courts, and the OSCE in particular, even joining with Scientology and other NGOs to petition for human rights issues with the OSCE. And undeniably, too, because of the inordinate place the society and governing body hold in the minds and hearts of Jehovah's Witnesses, a condition constantly reinforced by Bethel. From Jehovah's standpoint, the organization has become an idol. Most recently, the Watchtower Inc. has apparently become involved in hedge fund activity. Some of Jehovah's Witnesses may be inclined to rationalize and justify the Watchtower's apparent move into the world of Wall Street hedge funds. After all, Jesus' illustration of the slaves entrusted with their master's money condemns the slave who did not deposit his master's money in a bank so that his master might collect the interest. But to put things in perspective, Jesus' illustration is not about money at all. Money is merely a symbol of the gifts and responsibilities Jesus gives to his slaves in expectation of their using their gifts in his behalf. Moreover, as regards the literal money donated to the Watchtower by hardworking Jehovah's Witnesses and other generous donors, the Watchtower Treasury has heretofore deposited those monies with the banks and have drawn a modest amount of interest on those monies. The unseemly side of the hedge fund world is discussed in the article already cited, The Watchtower Hedge Fund. But in addition to the aforementioned, the entire Wall Street investment bank and hedge fund world is an extension of London's monetary and financial empire over the world. And London's empire is a hereditary extension of the Assyrian and Babylonian, Persian, Grecian, and Roman empires of prophecy. That is why the Book of Revelation and Daniel depict the symbolic beast as being composites made up of a collection of successive empires. Empires, by nature, are supranational, and that is certainly the intent of the London monetary empire today. That is evident when we take note of the fact that nations may issue their own currency, but it is from the privately owned central banks that they must borrow money in the form of debt sales. And it is the bankers who reap the interest from taxpayers. Also, a sovereign nation's financial affairs are often overridden by private banks and their imperial institutions, like the IMF. In recent years, the financier's power has been vividly displayed as the empire has forced nations into drastic austerity. People indispensable to a functional society, like teachers, police, nurses, firefighters, and emergency responders, are being axed in order to pay off the financier's bad gambling debts. And hedge funds have been an integral part of the apparatus used by the empire to plunder nations. The Watchtower is the proud recipient of the proverbial widow's mite and the donated lunch money of school children who wish to contribute to the work sponsored by the Kingdom of Christ. All indications are that the Watchtower is now intent on using a portion of those funds to share in the plunder of nations. The fact that the Watchtower Society is now intimately associated with the core appendages of the imperial system is an overt act of apostasy and faithlessness. So, it is the Watchtower Society itself that is the apostate nation of Isaiah's prophecy. But what is the significance of Assyria's success in conquering Israel and Jehovah's subsequent defense of Judah and Jerusalem? That represents an important aspect of what is to occur. Israel symbolizes the organization of Jehovah's Witnesses presently due to the presence of anointed persons who are in a covenant with God through Christ. As Jesus foretold, a disgusting thing is due to make desolate a place once considered by God to be holy. The takedown of the earthly organization, however, will coincide with the establishment of the heavenly Zion. The surviving remnant making up the seed of Israel will be gathered to heavenly Mount Zion. While they're still upon the earth following the desolation of the holy place, the beast will make an attempt to exterminate them entirely. In that respect, Jehovah will defend Jerusalem, that is, the heavenly New Jerusalem, then represented on earth by the remnant. His purpose will then be fully accomplished as the kingdom will then go into operation to crush the seed of the serpent out of existence. It is also during that period, in the aftermath of the removal of all persons doing lawlessness from Christ's kingdom, from his congregation, that the spiritual paradise will come into existence. But as regards the crash of the Watchtower Society, their apparent move into hedge funds may very well be the means of their undoing. As it stands presently, London's monetary system is rapidly approaching a dead end. Trillions upon trillions of dollars and pounds and whatever else have been created in recent years and thrown into the system to stave off collapse. But the money makers know that it is an endgame, terminal strategy, which at some point will create an even bigger blowout of the system. And when the system blows, there will be winners and there will be losers. Those with the actual title to the means of production will be the winners. Those holding worthless scraps of paper will be the losers. The 8th chapter of Daniel depicts the last king as a king fierce in countenance, who will bring the mighty ones to ruin, along with the people made up of holy ones. The 29th chapter of Isaiah portrays God's spokesman-like nation being silenced at the critical time of the empire's last campaign. Returning to the 10th chapter of Isaiah, these are the words attributed to the Assyrian. With the power of my hand I shall certainly act, and with my wisdom, for I do have understanding, and I shall remove the boundaries of peoples, and their things stored up I shall certainly pillage, and I shall bring down the inhabitants just like a powerful one, and just as if a nest my hand will reach the resources of the peoples. And just as when one gathers eggs that have been left, I myself will gather up even all the earth. And there will certainly be no one fluttering his wings or opening his mouth or chirping. The prophecies harmoniously envision the same development. So, when Jehovah terminates his work at Zion and Jerusalem and turns to the insolent Assyrian, the boastful words spoken that are attributed to the last kingdom verify that the empire is destined to crush and pillage all the nations, including that which belongs to Jehovah, removing national boundaries and plundering the middle class as well as the wealthy. Certainly, that is the stated intention of the London-centered empire today, and their capacity for causing financial ruin has already been demonstrated in the latest crisis. Not unlike the arrogant Assyrian, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, one Lloyd Blankfein, boasted a couple of years ago that he was doing God's work. We may assume that his fellow financiers are also doing God's work too. As it turns out, ironically, God may indeed have one last assignment for the empire's plundering agents. In all likelihood, the looming global financial blowout will bankrupt the society and cause their properties to be seized by their creditors. However it comes about, the fabled presses of Bethel are certain to roll to a standstill soon. In this way, Ariel will be silenced and humbled by means of the imperial stick that Jehovah will wield against his apostate nation. To be continued.